Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Fraser Nelson and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls to discuss Prime Minister's Questions, Universal Credit and the upcoming Brussels Summit. Now, we've just had a rather rambustious PMQs, and it seems, James, that Jeremy Corbyn, while not brilliant at this, is actually better than Theresa May, who's even worse.
Today was definitely a win for Jeremy Corbyn, and it was a win for Jeremy Corbyn even if you weren't grading on a curve. Jeremy Corbyn is never going to be a great forensic questioner in the House of Commons, but he's become more confident. And I think at the same time, Theresa May's confidence is going. She never really recovered from a moment when Corbyn said, "Will you pause universal credit?" And she said yes, and then paused very unfortunately. And all the Labour benches cheered, even though she obviously wasn't agreeing to actually pause universal credit. I also think that there's no lightness of touch there. And if you think the real importance of PMQs is what it does to the morale of your MPs, I thought by the end of the session, admittedly the session did go on for an incredibly long time because there's about 20 minutes of Burko speaking every time now, the Tory benches did not look energised or enthusiastic or happy. They all looked rather pained and like they'd rather be somewhere else.
Casey, any highlights for you?
I think for once Jeremy Corbyn seemed to be able to think on his feet a bit. There was a point when Theresa May praised him for the first time ever actually speaking positively about the fact unemployment was going down, but he hit back very quickly with a good riposte where he said perhaps for the first time ever Theresa May can now answer a question, and again it seemed to just kind of outmaneuver her again. The problem is she seems to be getting slightly worse and he seems to be getting better.
I guess, James, I mean, the general momentum, not since the general election, has been one of Labour slowly getting behind Corbyn. Corbyn finding out that his own performance, while not brilliant, is better for a man who can make his way through a whole speech. You know, even if he might read the wrong parts of an auto cue, at least he can finish it. And I wonder if, do you get the sense that this momentum is becoming self-reinforcing on both sides, on Labour's side on the way up and the Tory side on the way down?
He certainly looks more confident at PMQs. And part of that is because he looks more confident, he's in a better position. The Tory benches don't barrack him as much. So all the things are in his favour. Theresa May, you can tell that she is nervous. So she actually didn't start too badly in PMQs today. But when the yes thing went wrong, you can almost see, like an actor who's forgotten their lines once, you can see her, you can almost hear the voice in her head saying, "Oh God, not again." And that, I think, is a problem. And I think, because she sounds this uncertain trumpet, the Tory benches aren't really rowing in behind her, so it's much less noisy than it used to be.
Well, for those who didn't hear it, here's the yes part in Prime Minister's Questions.
Will the Prime Minister now pause universal credit and fix the problems before pressing ahead with the rollout?
Yes. Prime Minister!
Yes, it is absolutely right.
Theresa May at Prime Minister's Questions. And on the broader topic of universal credit, James, the Labour seems to think it has got the government on the run.
Yes, they are. I mean, the government are going to all sorts of lengths to try and avoid a vote on this tonight because they know that they would lose a vote because enough Tory MPs would at the very least abstain for the government's majority to disappear. The fundamental problem comes down to this, which is everyone on the government side likes to talk about this as being a delivery problem. It's actually a design question, which is universal credit, because it was trying to mimic the world of work, it means that you get paid in arrears. So there is a gap between applying to get universal credit and getting the money. And that, I think, is the problem, in that lots of people, because these are people on very often people on very, very low incomes, close to the breadline, but they are not capable of waiting the amount of time that the universal credit system requires you to wait. And I think the question now is, in the budget, do the government put more money into the system so that you get money straight away rather than having to wait 6 weeks as you do at the moment?
So, Katie, this looks like the government is going to concede. Also, now that Ian Duncan-Smith has left, I can't quite see who's championing universal credit. There's almost a consensus emerging how this is a very big government reform that's gone a little bit wrong, and nobody really wants to explain its virtues in the way that its architect, IDS, was once doing.
Yeah, I think it's a common theme at the moment that Conservatives are going along with lots of schemes and not necessarily giving the arguments for them. Yeah. I think particularly with this, though, we have David Gawke, who is now the Secretary of State there, and he's someone who is often deployed when there is a problem. We saw George Hopkinson do that many times.
Anytime you saw Gawke on television, you knew something had really gone wrong.
Exactly. He is there to troubleshoot, and you get the impression that's what he's doing here now. But And he might be able to do that, but at the same time, while they are going with the scheme, they need to be telling people why they're doing it and what the grand plan is. Because most MPs have a problem with the rollout, not universal credit in general. So it'd be good if at PMQs, Theresa May had actually explained a bit more why we have it.
Now, tomorrow she heads off to Brussels for a meeting with other EU leaders. Katie, what can we expect? She's had her dinner, with no idea how that went, presumably not the most entertaining moment of either of their lives, but should we expect any progress of any kinds when she goes to Brussels tomorrow?
I think we've heard a lot about acceleration. This is apparently what everyone agreed on at the dinner she had, and a lot about this new dynamic to talks, but probably what we're going to see is not much happen. At best, what she's looking for is this idea that everyone is agreeing the talks are moving fast. They can all say it. Doesn't mean it's happening. And ultimately, no one expects them to agree to move to trade at this meeting, but what the hope is when they meet again in December, that's when it will happen. So a suggestion that the light will turn green eventually is what she needs.
Now, James, the EU was quite insistent that the talks would be done exclusively through Monsieur Barnier and David Davis, that Theresa May would not be able to go and deal directly with any of her other counterparts. Now, when they said that, a lot of people thought, well, that's crazy, of course. She's just going to fly to Berlin, she'll have the thing stitched up with the Germans, and the EU will do what it's told. To a lot of people's surprise, the EU seems to have been quite disciplined in making sure that there are no bilateral talks. And even this summit, Theresa May is going to give a presentation about Brexit and then shuffle off to finish her dinner somewhere else, isn't she?
First round is where the EU27 are completely united because they all want to screw as much money out of the UK as possible. Whether you're a contributor country or a recipient country, you want as much money out of the UK. And I think there is a view that ultimately, as it gets nearer to December, the UK government, although they might find some ways to kind of subtly disguise it, it's put £20 billion on the table and it will end up putting more money on the table just as a way of kind of greasing the wheels of diplomacy. I do think that the other thing is it would be a massive mistake to think that Angela Merkel is going to ride to the rescue at any point.
Well, you know, she's still trying to piece together a coalition,
yeah,
isn't she?
And as David Cameron found out in his renegotiation, you know, that's not really how she operates. Indeed, if you look at the fact that, that there's no resolution to the Eurozone's problems, again, it's because Merkel doesn't. She, in this kind of fundamental German ambivalence about their own power in Europe, they don't really want to use their ability to push things through. And what I think is very striking is when you talk to senior people in the UK government, they actually find Macron much more helpful to their predicament than Merkel.
And Katie, can you see a situation here where there is not much progress in the EU talks and then the Tory party gets more and more united behind a no deal? Because no deal right now is perceived, certainly by most Tory backbenchers, as the most effective threat we have over the EU to say, look, we are, it's not you that's annoyed, but our lack of progress is we who are annoyed at yours, and look at this plan B that we're going to operate. So do you think this no deal drumbeat will get louder?
Yeah, I think so, definitely, because I think it will get the loudest if they do not, when they get to the second meeting in December, that is the meeting where people are really expecting them to give them some green light. And if they don't get the green light then, I think that is going to be when you see lots of people in the party say the EU are impossible to negotiate with. They don't want Britain to get anywhere on this. They don't particularly want us to have a deal. If they do want us to have a deal, it's a deal where everything is on their terms. We heard Barnier already said it is not a question of making concessions on any of the free issues, but she'd be suggesting that it wasn't a case of the EU making concessions. And I think that's when they're going to have to start actually thinking, well, now, and Philip Hammond particularly, now maybe we do need to start spending money to show that we are ready for this, rather than the Labour suggestion, which is just that we will take whatever we are given.
And James, what do you think the state of play in the Cabinet is on this? I mean, last week we emerged that there was a £250 million fund to spend on paperwork for no deal, not the actual hardware. And this is what's frustrated quite a few Cabinet members. I was speaking to one last week who was saying that, first of all, £250 million is not very much money when you think of how many problems we need to solve. And secondly, that only if you actually start to send some bulldozers into Dover to try to create a new port or something like that will the EU think you're actually serious. So even if you want a deal, you ought to physically prepare for no deal. But this remains a deeply controversial argument within the cabinet.
Yes, and other cabinet ministers who want a deal think the better way to improve a deal is to, and they make this argument to me, I hear this a lot from cabinet ministers, and not just cabinet ministers who voted Leave, it's important to note that fact. They basically argue, even if we spent a couple of billion unnecessarily, if that improved the deal that we end up getting from the EU by a couple of percentage points, that money would soon pay for itself. Mm. And also, lots of the extra things that you would be spending money on are things that you would need eventually anyway. So why not bring it forward and say, look, we're doing this. The worry, I think, which is the Philip Hammond worry, is essentially that, A, he's the Chancellor and Chancellors don't want to spend money. I think he also fears a kind of war by railway timetable theory, which is if you start to prepare for no deal, you end up getting no deal because he thinks that everyone in the cabinet says, oh, well, there's the no deal plan, let's go down that route. I think there is a fundamental lack of trust in the cabinet right now to a quite remarkable extent. Serious cabinet ministers genuinely believe that Philip Hammond doesn't want to prepare for no deal because he wants the UK to have to accept,
for ideological reasons,
whatever it is offered by the EU, on the grounds that whatever it is offered by the EU, however bad, would be better than no deal. So he wants to ensure that Theresa May has to accept that. And on the other hand, you have cabinet ministers who genuinely think that when Michael Gove, Chris Grayling and Boris Johnson push for weekly updates in the cabinet on no deal, that's because they want to collapse the talks. You know, I said this last weekend. I really do think that Theresa May needs to get the cabinet together and get them to agree a Brexit position. Because what is going on right now is that because they don't really ever talk about the big Brexit issue, the question of the end state in cabinet, they're all beginning to think the worst of each other. They're all beginning to suspect each other's motives. And without some kind of unity, this is all going to come crashing down in a terrible fashion.
Now, Katie Emberrud was asked yesterday about no deal, and she gave what seemed to me to be a pre-prepared answer. Here it is.
I think it is unthinkable that there would be no deal. It is so much in their interest as well as in ours, in their communities, in their families, in their tourists' interest, to have something in place. We will make sure that there is something between them and us to maintain our security.
So is she signalling, Katie, that she's actually behind Philip Hammond in the divide that James talks about here? I'm trying to get a sense for whether Hammond is isolated or whether we've got two evenly balanced sides.
Well, I think we were given a big clue at the weekend that she's quite sympathetic to Philip Hammond when Nicky Morgan went on Pasted on Sunday and said a very senior female cabinet minister had confided in her.
Right. So that means that she's Amber Rudd's in the habit of calling up Nicky Morgan, who we know is very anti-Brexit.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone who remembers, you know, any of the debates in the EU referendum would really mistake Amber Rudd for a Brexiteer. We know she was a very ardent Remainer.
But what we didn't know was whether she was doing things behind the scene, though. She gave the impression to me, anyway, of being a Home Secretary, who thought, OK, I've lost the argument, but I'm going to support the Prime Minister. But Nicky Morgan's little slip last week led to the suspicion, actually, maybe Amber Rudd is working behind the scenes with Philip Hammond because she regards herself as being on the opposite side to the
battle. She was the cabinet minister who weighed in behind Philip Hammond when Michael Gove and Chris Grayling and Boris Johnson were pushing for these weekly no-deal updates. She was the one who backed the Hammond position on those preparations.
She's definitely seen as being in the Hammond camp to some degree, but she's definitely not as disruptive as him. And she is much more respected and liked by her cabinet colleagues than Philip Hammond, who has sometimes seemed to have like a real vengeance against Brexit, rather than someone who was on the other side and is trying to see both sides. I also think there are two types of no deals here. So what she, I think, is particularly opposed to is a no deal where you don't have any agreements on things like security, which I think lots of people would agree would be a potential, like, a very big problem, depending. Yeah. Whereas there is another version of no deal where you don't specifically, say, have the trade agreement and you WTO, and that is not seen as a disaster by many people at all. It's seen as a potentially good thing, and it's not clear if she meant that.
So, James, will this Brussels summit do anything to try to heal the cabinet? Because the rift seems to be getting worse rather than better, and the sense of dysfunction seems to be becoming more visible.
The rift is getting worse because they're not talking about the big question, which is when the EU moves on to trade in December and the EU turns around and says to the UK, what do you want? At the moment, the UK does not have an answer to that question. It can tell you what it doesn't want. It doesn't want to be in the single market and the customs union. It doesn't want to be EEA minus. And Theresa May keeps saying she doesn't want to be CETA plus, which then raises the question of what does she want to be? And I know that they say that she says she wants a bespoke deal, but I've never been lucky enough to buy a bespoke seat. But if one did have the money, give me various, to buy a bespoke seat, I think you still have to tell the tailor what style of suit you want before they can start cutting the cloth.
James and Katie, thank you very much indeed. You can subscribe to this podcast, Coffee House Shots, on the iTunes Store, and to the magazine itself from just £1 a week on spectator.co.uk/podoffer. If you follow that link, you'll be able to get a free Moleskine notebook thrown in with your £12 deal. My thanks to Nick Hilton, who produced this podcast.